So in terms of discussing the Mishkan, so we've been discussing each vessel week by week. So we discussed the Aron, the Holy Ark, we discussed the Kruvim, the covering over the Ark, the cherubim on top, we discussed the Shulchan, which was the table that contained the showbreads. So the next one, in terms of the order of the Torah, is the Menorah. Within the main chamber of the Mishkan and of the Beis Hamikdash, the Holy Temple, there were three vessels, as we discussed in the previous weeks. There was the incense altar, there was the table containing the showbreads, and there was the menorah. That was what was contained in the main room of the temple. And back behind that was the Holy of Holies, which contained the Holy Ark. So the menorah, we're very used to discussing menorah around Hanukkah time, but the menorah was a fixture in the Beis Hamikdash year-round. There was a daily service done on the menorah. The Kohen would come and he would clean out the candles. He would put in a new wick, new oil, and light them every single night. And they would burn throughout the night, every single night of the year, in the Beis Hamikdash, even on Shabbos. They could light that fire on Shabbos. There's a special license the Torah gives the Kohen. Even if they don't light fires on Shabbos, he was allowed to light the menorah on Shabbos. So the menorah was a daily service, a very important part of the Beis Hamikdash. So as we've been doing in the past few weeks, we'll first just discuss the details of the menorah, and then we'll get some symbolism behind it all. The menorah was made out of pure gold, solid gold. The other vessels we discussed, a lot of them had wood on the inside and were gold-plated. The menorah was solid gold all the way through. There's some pictures. Again, I don't vouch for the accuracy of the pictures, but they give us at least some concept of what it looked like. It's a dispute if the menorah had rounded branches or straight branches. So you can see this book actually has both versions. Has a possibility of rounded branches, possibly straight branches.
We just don't know.
Yeah, we're not sure. It's a dispute amongst the commentaries. The main commentary, such as Rashi, he says that it had straight branches. So I think we're more accustomed to seeing this picture. This one seems to be most accurate according to the main commentaries, the one with the straight branches. So it's an interesting thing. But the menorah consisted of essentially four different parts. You had on the bottom, let's pull this one out. You had on the bottom the base. The base was just a little base with three little feet coming out of it. That was on the bottom. There was the middle branch, which goes straight up. And off that middle branch came the other six branches of the menorah. There are seven candles on the menorah in the Beis Hamikdash, as opposed to our Hanukkah menorah has eight branches on it. But they lit seven candles daily on this menorah. So that's the second part, was really this middle branch with all the branches coming out of it. There were decorations on the menorah. The Torah describes three different types of decorations of the menorah. There was what was called kaftor. Kaftor was like knobs. The Gemara says they're apple-shaped knobs, so this picture doesn't show it. But these knobs here were apple-shaped knobs on the menorah. That was one decoration on the menorah. There were flowers, which you can see also in the picture. They put some flowers here in the picture. And there was also gvi'in, which are some sort of cup or goblet, which is also part of the decoration of the menorah. Seeing the pictures, you know, there's certainly a dispute as to exactly how it was set up. Different commentaries have a different structure of the menorah in terms of where exactly the knobs were, where the flowers were, where the cups were, what the cups looked like. I mean, there's a lot of dispute involved in that. So when we're ready to make a new menorah, you know, we'll have hopefully the divine prophecy will teach us what to do. But the menorah consisted of all these decorations in a very exact formation. It wasn't just that the designer said, okay, put a flower here, a knob here. God said the knob should go there, the flower should go there, the cup should go there. Every single inch of menorah was defined exactly what should be put on that inch. So
In this discussion, do they also discuss any of the meanings behind, you know, what each decoration?
Yeah, so we'll try to touch upon that to some degree. But there is a lot of discussion behind that as well.
Okay.
The top part was seven candles. There were seven little cups which held oil. The cups had covering over them, which you did with a hole so you could start the wick. And the Kohen every single night would take out the old wick or the oil and relight the menorah every single night. That was the seven branches, the seven candles on top. As we've said with other vessels of the Mishkan, it was what's called miksha achas. It was all made of one solid piece of gold. You cannot make each part and connect it. It was all molded out of one solid piece of gold. So the Aron was made that way, and the Shulchan was made, the parts of the Shulchan made that way as well, the crown on the Shulchan. This is extremely complex. To make this out of one solid piece of gold and to mold it in that way is extremely, extremely complex. So the rabbis actually tell us that Moshe himself just couldn't understand what to do. Moshe says he was niskasha. He was bothered. He couldn't figure out how to make the menorah. So God said, you know what? Take a block of gold, toss it into the fire, and I'll make it for you. So the Gemara actually tells us that God himself formed the menorah. Moshe was shown a vision of the menorah. He said, I don't know how to do it. God said, take your block of gold, toss it into the furnace, and out popped a fully made menorah. That's what the rabbis teach us. So it was so complicated that Moshe couldn't even figure out what to do with it. So God had to make it himself.
That must have been very heavy.
Yes, it's pure gold. I'm sure it was very heavy.
What the size?
So it was 18 tefachim tall, which is approximately 72 inches. So yeah, that's about 6 feet. Yeah, 6 feet tall. And it's spread out 2 amos, which is about 4 feet. So 6 feet tall, about 4 feet wide. So it's considerable size. All solid gold. Well, in the desert, they moved it around. In the desert, they had to take it place to place, and they were traveling in the desert. So it was definitely moved at that time in history. Yeah, I mean, the Levites would carry the different vessels of the temple, so I guess they had their methods of how to do it. But, yeah, right? Oh, you're a Levi, right? Okay, yeah. So you have to be training to do your job.
That's where we're brought up then.
It could have been a miracle.
Right, possible. Yeah, I don't know how it was carried. What's another interesting point is that the other vessels actually had poles attached to them to help them carry. There's no poles attached to the menorah. So the menorah had to be carried, I guess, by the branches or by the bottom. I don't know how they carried the menorah. But the ark had two poles on either side. The shulchan, the table, had poles on either side. The menorah had no poles, so they had to just grab it as is. So it probably was difficult to carry, I imagine. And very valuable as well. Something that large, solid gold. Extremely valuable. I mean, that's why you can see on the Arch of Titus in Rome, this picture of the Romans carrying out the menorah from the temple. Because that was quite a valuable find for the Romans when they destroyed the temple, was the menorah. That's the picture in the Arch of Titus, which you can still see to this very day, is the Romans carrying out the menorah from the temple itself. So what happened to that menorah, we're unsure, but it definitely is a valuable piece of furniture to have around. That's definitely one possibility, as they say.
There's people negotiating, I've heard, to get it out.
Yeah.
But now the change of pope.
But who knows, right. But is it really there, I guess, is the question. Could be there. It's very, very possible it's there.
Where do people think it is?
The Vatican. Because it went to Rome. And then when the Catholic Church took over Rome, where did all the wealth of Rome go? It went to the Catholic Church. Where do they hide all of their wealth? The Vatican. That's one theory out there.
Okay. In the basement, in the concubine? So.
I guess. I don't know the...
Where do things hide in the basement, you know, the bottom
floor? I guess somewhere. And they must have dungeon storehouses. I don't know
tomb.
What they have down
Maybe
there.
Somebody's tomb.
Yeah.
They've got layers and layers of stuff stashed in there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they've got like sub basements.
I think they would come out and pray if they knew they saw it themselves. It somehow would leak out if they knew it was there. So
right.
It must be in somebody's tomb.
Right. That's also possible. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. 6 feet by 4 feet.
Yeah, piece of gold.
Would it be the size of the tomb?
Right. Yeah.
So it could be buried with somebody too.
Right. That's possible. Yes. So I don't know. So that's a theory, which is it's a reasonable theory that it's in the Vatican. There are scholars working on negotiating the Vatican for ancient Jewish artifacts. So it could be that maybe one day this will, reappear from the Vatican. Who knows? But that's the dimensions of the menorah. One interesting thing about the menorah is that the Torah does not record its dimensions. The rabbis tell us the dimensions were, as we said, were 18 tefachim, which is about 72 inches, and it was 2 amos wide, about 4 feet wide. But the Torah does not record its dimensions. The Torah does record the dimensions of the other vessels of the Mishkan. So we'll try to discuss later how come these dimensions are missing from the Torah itself. We'll try to get to that point. Just one, one side point, but just an interesting point. We said Moshe himself didn't know how to make the menorah. God showed him a vision. Moshe said, I can't do it. God said, okay, I'll take care of it for you. So what's the lesson that we can learn from that story? And God was well aware Moshe couldn't make the menorah, but God still showed Moshe the vision and said, Moshe, try to make it. And Moshe had to go through the process of finding the gold and tossing it into the fire. And then God said, okay, I'll let the menorah pop out of this fire fully made. So a lesson for us in our lives is that we always have a vision. We have to know what we're aiming for. We can always get there. But we can put forth our proper efforts, and then God helps us get the rest of the way. That's what you see in that story. Moshe had a vision. I want to make a menorah. It's difficult. I don't know what to do. So God says, okay, you do what you can. At least take a block of gold. At least make a fire. At least toss it in. Do whatever you can do, and I'm going to take care of the rest. So lesson for us in our lives as well. If we have a vision, that's something we're working towards. So as long as we put forth our efforts and we try, so God says, I'll assist you to get the rest of the way. Assuming it's the proper direction we should be going in. That's one lesson you can find from that story. So let's just, we'll go through the details a little bit more, and then we'll get to some other messages you get from the menorah. This bottom part, this is called the Yerech, this base, was a hollow golden box, hollow inside. It had these three little feet coming out of it. Coming up from it was this middle pole. On top of the middle pole was the middle Ner, the middle candle. That was on top of this middle pole. And that candle was going straight up. The hole in that candle was right in the center of it. The other branches, as you can see in the picture, the hole for the wick was actually on the side, facing towards the center candle. Because the Torah tells us that all the flames should be pointed in one direction. So you can see another picture as well. The flame in the middle is straight in the center. The flame on the sides are all pointing towards that center flame.
I don't know how it balanced being on 3 feet. It had to be something in the back.
Right. That's what I was thinking about, the 3 feet.
Right. I mean, you have 2 feet in the back and one in the middle of the front, it'll stand.
If it's wide enough. You
know? Yeah, if it's wide enough. Right. So, I mean, I guess it was heavy enough also that it would stay put on the floor. As you can see also, and I'll take this picture, this is the main understanding of the menorah. They all came to a level, they're all on the same level on the top. So this branch obviously is longer than this branch. The lower the branch, the longer it was, so they'd all end up being on the same level at the top of the menorah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. There you go. Okay. Yeah. So you can see that all the candles ended up on the same level of height, even though they started off in different places along the menorah. So they had to make the lower branches longer than the upper branches. The knobs, we said, were apple-shaped. There's cups and flowers. And on these cups and flowers and knobs, which is not depicted on this picture, the Torah says that they should be decorated with almonds. Meshukadim. They're decorated with almonds. Meshukadim. Right. So the again, is a dispute how the decoration actually looked. But it was either almonds were etched into the decorations, or they were actually coming out, you know, in a 3D image from the decorations. But the decorations, on the decorations, were almonds. So on the cups, there are almonds. On the flowers, there are almonds. And on the knobs, there are also almonds. Almond decorations. We'll discuss the symbolism of almonds as well.
Gold.
It's all gold, yeah. Again, it had to be one solid piece of gold form, which is why God had to make it himself. So that's the idea of the almonds. I'm not sure if the shells were on or not. No.
Salted.
Honey roasted. Right. The cups on top, which held the oil, so they held what was called the measurement is called a log in the Torah. A log is approximately between 0.3 and 0.6 liters. Just picture 1 liter bottle of seltzer, like a half of that. That's the amount of oil that each cup held. It's a lot of oil. It burns a long time. The halacha is it had to burn throughout the entire night. So they place in a half log of oil nightly, because a half log of oil would be sufficient for the longest winter night. So every single night, they'd always put in the same amounts, even though it was a short summer night, so that on a long winter night, it would also burn for the entire night. But it would be burning the entire night, every night, in the Beis HaMikdash.
But it couldn't go through all of Shabbat without having to be refilled?
Well, because they would light it on Friday night. Or they lit like us on Saturday night before it got dark. They had to light it before it got dark. So on Saturday night before dark, they would be lighting the menorah as well. And they would light, it would burn all night long again. I mean, you're saying they maybe could have put in enough oil to last.
Yeah, that's what I don't get.
But
it's
the mitzvah was to
so
light
much.
It daily. They had a mitzvah to light it daily,
okay,
so that wouldn't count.
That,
yeah,
okay.
Right. That's the question, right? Good. So that was the service. They used pure olive oil. That's why the Hanukkah story is about olive oil. It was pure olive oil was what they would use. It had to be, you know, the very first drop. I guess extra virgin plus, you know, the very first drop out of the olive. That's what was used. It was the finest oil used in the temple. Was used for menorah. They also had oil offerings. In the flower offerings, they used oil, but they didn't have to use the same quality oil as they would in the menorah. The menorah had the finest quality oil that they had in the temple. There was one candle, the Western candle, which miraculously would continuously burn. Always. The Western candle, is actually a dispute which one's called the Western candle, because it's a dispute which way the menorah was oriented. So if the menorah was east-west, the Western candle would be the one all the way in the west. If the menorah was north-south, so the middle one, I believe, would be the Western candle, because that was the one... Isn't that right? Maybe that's not the right one. I forgot what the other opinion was, but there were two opinions. Which one was called the Western candle? I'm confusing it. But bottom line is there was one candle, it was the Western candle, and that candle, miraculously, at least during the good times, would burn constantly, would not go out. They would light all the other candles from that candle. They would never have to bring a new fire to the menorah. That candle, that fire was constantly lit. It was an eternal flame. The Gemara does tell us that at a certain point, when the Jews were not following God's will, the miracles ceased to exist in the Beis HaMikdash. So even though they had miracles constantly in the Beis HaMikdash during the good times, when we started sinning, those miracles slowly started to die out. But that was one miracle which was constant in the Beis HaMikdash during the good times. So that is the details of the Nora. So I want to try to go through some of the symbolism. Obviously, there's many details. There's a lot here. Again, we'll touch the tip of the iceberg when it comes to symbolism, but at least we'll take one lesson out of it, try to apply it to the menorah, to the menorah's makeup. Before we get to that, one lesson I want to discuss, just to focus on the simple meaning of this divine service. There was a service daily in the temple of lighting the menorah. What was the meaning behind that service? So the Sefer HaChinuch writes that the simple understanding of this service was to increase the glory and splendor of the Beis HaMikdash itself, because having a lit house is much more honorable than having a dark house. That's the simple meaning. So all night long, the Beis HaMikdash was lit up. No electric lighting in those days. The way you lit it up was through candles. So it was a mitzvah that the Beis HaMikdash always be light. During the daytime, there was sunlight. And during the nighttime, there was the light of the menorah. That would light the entire chamber of the Beis HaMikdash. So that's a simple understanding. It was for the honor and glory of God, the honor and glory of the Beis HaMikdash. That's what it was for. It would bring into a person the fear of God, the reverence for God, and humility to see a building that was so majestic. And it was. Walking into the temple, as I mentioned before, was a very majestic experience. It was awe-inspiring. You would see a gorgeous building, divine service, total focus, total devotion to God, and every aspect of it led us to those feelings. So one aspect was it should be lit in a glorious way at all times to show the honor of the building. That's a simple understanding.
Honor of the building.
In which is the honor of God. That's what it is. But so that's the main simple understanding. But to take it on a deeper level, the menorah symbolizes something much more than that. The menorah symbolizes to us the light of Torah. And we'll elaborate on that, because we did discuss the Aron, the Holy Ark, a few weeks ago, and that also symbolized the Torah. So we have to differentiate between the dimension of the Torah symbolized by the Ark and the dimension of the Torah symbolized by the menorah. It says in the book of Mishlei and Proverbs that Torah is Or. Torah is compared to light. Torah is our light. So menorah, which gives off the light of the temple, corresponds to the light of Torah. So I want to quote for you from the commentary of the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was one of the great leaders in Europe. He lived in, I believe, the city of Volozhin, which was, I think, Lithuania, probably in the mid to late 1800s. And he has a commentary on the Torah called the Hamek Dover. And he discusses in his commentary the symbolism of the menorah from his perspective. So he describes that the Torah comes to us in two different elements in the Beis HaMikdash. You have the Aron, the Ark, and you have the menorah, which is the light of Torah. What do those two things symbolize? What's the distinction between the two? He says that the Ark itself represents the part of Torah which is as was given by God at Mount Sinai. It's the body of Torah. So, for instance, God taught to Moshe at Mount Sinai. He taught him, the five books of the Torah. God taught him the oral tradition. And that was, Moshe took that and received that from God. Moshe had no input into that. Moshe was a tape recorder. Moshe recorded everything God told him, and Moshe repeated it to the nation. And Moshe had no personal input into that part of the Torah. Moshe didn't add of his own. He was just he was a servant of God, passing on the divine tradition from Mount Sinai. And that's represented by the Holy Ark and the Holy of Holies. That's where you have the tablets, Ten Commandments were sitting in the Holy of Holies. The original Torah scroll of Moses was sitting there, either in the Aron, next to the Aron, one of those two places. There was the original Torah scroll from Moshe. The broken tablets were there. That represents the Torah set in stone, literally in stone tablets, as given by God at Mount Sinai. But there's another element to Torah, which is that throughout the generations, we have to draw out new lessons from the Torah. Not every single thing in the Torah was given to Moshe directly. And I want to be clear about this, because I'm about to enter into dangerous waters. So I don't want to say anything which is the mainstream understanding of how we understand what Moshe received versus what we have nowadays is that Moshe received the entire body of the written text, certainly, and the body of the Oral Torah. By the Oral Torah, which now is embodied through the Talmud, the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Talmud, also the Midrashim, all the works from the ancient rabbis of the Talmud. So that is something which Moshe was given all the tools and all the lessons of the oral Torah, but there is room for what's called chiddush. The idea of chiddush is that there is an ability to draw out novel understandings from the Torah which were not there 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And this is where I'm getting to the dangerous course. But what do I mean by that? Because there are people who have taken this over the generations in a very wrong direction. So I just want to be very clear what I mean. God gave along with the Torah. He says, this is the Torah. These are the ways in which you can draw out lessons of Torah. What God said to Moshe, it doesn't seem that God sat down with Moshe and taught him every single, if you walk into, let's say, the yeshiva, look at the walls, there's thousands and thousands of books. God did not teach to Moshe, every single book sitting there on the wall of the yeshiva of Greater Washington. What did God teach to Moshe? God taught to Moshe, this is the methodology of how you can draw out the truth of the Torah. Torah is understood in many, many ways. There's 70 faces of the Torah, the rabbis tell us. There are four different levels of Torah. There's the pshat, the simple understanding. There's Kabbalistic understandings. There's so many different areas and levels and dimensions of Torah. So Moshe was given everything you possibly need in history to draw out every single ounce of truth from the Torah. But was Moshe taught every single word that was written in every single book we've had in history? Not necessarily every single word, but he was given the tool to draw those words out. And he passed down those tools to us. And we still have those tools this very day. Different ways in which we can draw out lessons of Torah, different ways in which we can understand the halachas in the Torah, the stories of the Torah. That's what Moshe was given. But there is a concept called, we call it chiddush. You go into, yeah.
I'm sorry. What are you defining as tools again? Please?
Tools. So tools are, there are different ways of how one can expound upon verses. And God taught us those ways. There's a concept called kal v'chomer in Hebrew, which means that if you see something, there's actually an English term in law books, I forgot what it's called for it, but if you see something, which is a very serious halacha, you can apply that same rule to a less serious halacha. That type of thing. We wouldn't have the right to do such a thing if God didn't tell us we could. But God said, you can take my Torah, and these are the ways in which you can draw out lessons from the Torah. To discuss all those ways, it'd be a different discussion. But but that was all part of the system. God gave a system to Moshe. It wasn't just a book. It was a system. And therefore, throughout history, people are using those same tools Moshe was given by God, and God gave us this right to apply and to draw out what's called a chiddush from the Torah. If you go to any yeshiva, one of the greatest things that a student in yeshiva can do is have his own chiddush. What it means to have your own chiddush is that you've taken a difficult section of Torah, and you've now developed a novel understanding to help understand that section of the Torah. So it was a very difficult passage. We didn't understand what it meant. And someone says, I have a unique idea which will help us understand this. And with that idea, you can understand what the Torah is teaching you. That's what we call a chiddush. And that's really the...
How do you spell that?
C-H-I-D-D-U-S-H. Chiddush. From the word chadash in Hebrew is new. It's something new. So the in the world of Torah study and yeshivas, that's one of the greatest things a student can do is develop a chiddush. That's what people look for. But it doesn't mean that Torah changes. It doesn't mean that we can take something which is there and ignore it, or reinterpret it in a different way or manipulate it. It means I'm just drawing out what is there. So there's a difference between drawing out what's there rather than changing or manipulating what's there. And there's a very fine line between the two, which is a dangerous line to be on. But we can never change Torah, we can never manipulate the Torah, we can never ignore parts of the Torah, but what we can do is try to draw out more and more lessons from parts of the Torah, or develop our own understandings of the text which is there. We can't change the text. We can't go against the text. That's that fine line. So the Netziv, with the commentary that we're quoting from, he says that what the menorah represents, the light of the menorah is the, let's call it, the human contribution to the Torah. The holy ark is the Torah as God gave to Moshe, but it's meant for the human being to come and draw out the lessons. And it applies on many levels. So for instance, can you drive a car on Shabbos? So, Moshe, I don't know if you knew about cars or not. Certainly the nation did not know about cars at the time. The Torah doesn't say anything explicitly about cars. But
ride your chariot.
Can you ride your chariot? Right. We have to have ways to figure that out. Because, that was not in the text of the Torah. We have to apply it. So application is one area. What would be the halachas involved in, digital information? Can I copy a CD? Is that legal according to halacha or not? Is a microwave considered cooking on Shabbos? Is a microwave considered cooking of meat and milk? Can you microwave? There's so many modern day questions which come up, which you have to apply from the Torah But it's not in the Torah itself. You have to be someone who understands how to draw out from the Torah and apply it to other situations. That's one area we call Chiddush. Another area would be to see deeper lessons in a certain story. You can read stories of the Torah, and the Torah is something which is so deep, and there's endless information, endless depth that enriches the Torah. So every single person, based on our own unique perspectives, can draw out different lessons from different parts of the Torah. And that's also, everyone, we have a tradition that everyone has their own portion in the Torah, which means that there's something in the Torah which each and every one of us will draw out, which no one in history has ever drawn out from it. A piece of truth, a piece of information which God intended for us to draw out, but it is left up to each individual, based on their own life experience, to draw that piece out. Everyone has their chilek b'Torah. We daven, give us our portion in your Torah. So our portion in Torah, everyone has their own unique portion of the Torah. And there's going to be, whether it could be, so for some people, you have great rabbis who have produced books and books and books, which would not have been around if they didn't produce them, but that was what God intended out of that section of the Torah. Some people might just have one understanding of one verse in the Torah is unique to them. And they've introduced that to the world, and wouldn't have been here if not for that person. But we all have our own unique way of interpreting the Torah, which is something that God intended to be there, which we have to draw out throughout history. So the menorah is what represents that aspect of Torah, what we can draw out. The human involvement, the understanding, the disseminating of Torah, drawing out the new lessons, the applications of Torah, and that is something which is left to the human being in every generation. That's the menorah. The light of the Torah, the menorah produces light. The fact that the Torah can illuminate our lives is based on how we draw out the lessons and spread them and disseminate them. The Torah sitting in an aron, you know, in the shul, behind closed doors, doesn't help anybody. But once we study the Torah and we're able to shine forth its light, that's what brings light to the world. That's the menorah's role in terms of Torah. So the aron is the body of Torah from God to Moshe and Mount Sinai. That's what that represents. And that has to remain as is, unchanging, unwavering. This is the body of divine wisdom, which the world will have for eternity. But now it's up to us to take that and spread it and to develop it and understand it in a way which applies to our lives. Again, within the guidelines that God has set out for us and without ever changing or going against anything said in the Torah. But so every single application of Torah, done correctly, that's what God intended of the Torah. That was God's intent at the time. The Midrash tells us that there was a great sage, Rabbi Tarfon. When Rabbi Tarfon would hear somebody relate to him a good chiddush, a novel thought in Torah, which he felt was true, he would say the words kaftor v'aferach. Kaftor v'aferach means a knob and a flower, referring to the knobs and the flowers of the menorah. That's how he would respond to it. Kaftor v'aferach. So the simple understanding would be, oh, he's saying it's beautiful, like a flower is beautiful. But he's saying something very deep. He's alluding to the fact that the ability to speak novel ideas of Torah is based on the menorah itself. So he would say, wow, your novel idea is, you know, the kaftor of these knobs, the perach is these flowers, it's a kaftor of a perach. What a beautiful idea. Because the menorah presents that, you know, the Torah blossoms and develops and brings forth fruits and flowers. These are apple-shaped knobs. Fruits and flowers based on how humans teach Torah and spread Torah. So he'd always respond, kaftor of a perach, it's a beautiful new Torah thought. And he's teaching us that lesson, the idea of a Torah thought, that is symbolized by the menorah. The Gemara tells us, the Gemara in Maseches Brachos tells us, there's a whole section on dreams, the Gemara in Brachos. And the Gemara tells you, if you see certain items in a dream, this is what it represents. So the Gemara says, one who sees olive oil in a dream should look forward to the light of the Torah. Because that refers to the menorah, the olive oil of the menorah. If you see that in your dream, that means that you should anticipate the light of Torah. You see what in a dream? Olive oil? I see. One of your dreams, olive oil there. So olive oil represents the light of Torah. If you see that in a dream, you should look forward to the light of Torah, it says. That you should anticipate in your life. So in the Holy of Holies, you have the Aron, the frozen Torah, frozen in stone. In the Heichal, in the outer room of the temple, which was the room which we actually accessed. The Holy of Holies was only accessed once a year by the Kohen Gadol. That was it. That was out of our sight, out of our minds. But the outer room of the temple, the holy, the Heichal, that was used daily by the Kohanim. And what makes Torah accessible and shine forth to the world is the menorah. That's our involvement in applying the Torah and drawing out the Torah's lessons. We discussed how each part of the menorah was decorated with almonds, which you don't see on the picture here. But this is Meshukadim, Shkedim, is decorated with almonds. So what's the concept of an almond? The Hebrew word also, Hebrew for almonds is almonds or shkedim. The root of that is the word shaked. Shaked is used throughout the Tanakh as a word meaning diligence, to rush to do something, to apply yourself, to be devoted. That's the word.
Zrizus
would be another word.
That's a hard part.
Right. There's a pasuk, it says, I think, l'shaked al sosai tamid. They're constantly devoting themselves to my doorway, as God said, you know, to the temple, to the synagogues, to the Beis Medrash, to the Torah study. So the idea of a shkedim, of a nut, of an almond, it alludes to the idea of diligence, of study. Why the almond is the symbol for that, I'm not totally sure. The commentaries explain that almonds grow very fast. I've never actually seen an almond tree. I don't know how they grow. The commentaries explain that almonds do grow very fast. We can do a little research on that. But the words are certainly the same exact root for an almond and for diligence, for a shakid, shakdu. So the wisdom of Torah, the power for us to develop and produce new Torah thoughts, novel ideas that are true and based on the Word of God, that comes through Torah study with diligence, devotion in Torah study, with toil in Torah. That's where it comes from. If we casually just read through Torah here and there, we're never going to develop a true Torah thought which is unique to ourselves. But if we diligently study Torah, we think about it, we focus on it, we toil in it, we really strive to understand the Torah to its depth. So that's where people develop true applications and true novel thoughts in Torah. So that's the idea of the shkedim, of the nuts decorating the menorah. Wisdom is always symbolized by light, as we said before. Torah is considered light. Menorah gives forth light. Why is wisdom defined by light? I mean, very simply, in English we say, I see the light. You know, when there's a thought that, you know, it hits us and say, wow, I understand, finally, you say, I've been enlightened. And we use those words, I've been enlightened, I've seen the light. That's what we say. But what's the deeper understanding of that statement? Because light is what enables us to see what's around us. Wisdom enables us to understand the world around us. So light, if it's a dark room, I can't see what's around me, I don't understand what's in front of me. When you turn on the lights, now I understand what's around me. In terms of the intellect, if I don't have wisdom, so I can see a lot around me, but I don't really understand it. I don't understand the world. I'm missing that tool, that medium, which helps me understand. But having the light of Torah is what allows me to understand the world. So now I have, my life is lit up, because now I understand what's around me. That's what Torah teaches us. That's why Torah is compared to the light. I know, I've seen the light. That's what that means, in all senses. The seven branches of menorah represent different branches of wisdom. I don't know the first source of this, but classically, many, both Jewish and I think other even non-Jewish philosophical works discuss the seven wisdoms. That there are seven basic wisdoms to the world. Don't ask what they are. I don't know. But it's a common phrase that there are seven wisdoms to the world. The seven branches of the menorah represent seven wisdoms. And they're all pointing in one direction because it all points back to the understanding of God. Now, the God put into this world many different areas of wisdom. And the purpose of them all is to always bring us back to God once again. Some of them, you know, may take us on a loop to get there. Ultimately, every single wisdom in the world is God's wisdom. God placed it in the world for a reason. So the seven branches of the menorah represent the seven wisdoms. And we should know that all those wisdoms should be subordinate to the Torah. And also, the wisdom should be helps understand the Torah. Science, medicine, math, language, those all do help us understand the Torah as well. How is it that a great Torah sage has to also rule on questions of surgery, has to rule on questions of technology? So he has to have understanding of medicine to some degree, understanding of technology to some degree. The halachic authorities will actually consult with doctors and scientists because they have to understand what they're talking about. You can't rule on a life and death question of a surgery, understanding the human body, understanding the surgery. So many rabbis have those doctors to which they consult, you know, in certain questions so that they can understand the world, understand those wisdoms, because those are wisdoms which are very valuable for Torah life itself and for the Torah itself. There's, you know, pages of the Talmud which discuss math, you know, the math, applying it to halakha, but there's an entire page of the Talmud discussing pi, because we have to know, you know, how to figure out the area of a circle for certain halakha questions. It discusses pi. There's other areas of the Talmud discussing math questions, because those are needed. The great Vilna Gaon, who was, you know, probably the greatest genius in the past few centuries of Torah thought, he was known for also his expertise in math. He developed a theorem in math, which is actually quoted in many math books, apparently. He's known to be a math whiz, and he actually would study math. But his off time was basically in the bathroom. That was his off time. You know, that's when he was studying. Other than he was studying the Torah, but he was known.
I'm sorry. Was he the rabbi that was here about a year ago?
Oh no, the only one lived in the 1700s.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No,
we're interested
if he was. Yeah, we're interested if he was.
There was a
math scholar
that came last year.
Yeah. I don't know his name. Really? I don't know who that was. I mean, the Vilna Gaon was the Lord Gaon means a genius. He was the greatest genius of Torah thought in centuries. He basically locked himself in a room, studied 22 hours a day. He slept 2 hours a day total, usually half-hour intervals. And he just studied and studied and wrote and wrote and taught and taught. And
when did he live?
It was, I think the late 1700s, around there, in Vilna, that's where he lived. And really, a most modern-day Torah thought somehow links itself back to him, you know, both in the world of halacha, in the world of Kabbalah, in the world of Musar, everything links back to him. He was such a genius, such a powerful teacher, that really every single aspect of modern-day Torah thought really finds its source somehow in the Vilna Gaon's teachings. He's really an amazing person.
What's his name again?
Vilna Gaon. The word in Hebrew is Gaon. His name was Rabbi Eliyahu. Kramer, that's his real name. But everyone refers to him just simply as the Vilna Gaon, the genius of Vilna. Because that's what he's the genius. Yeah, it's Kramer. You related to Kramers? Really? There are a lot of Kramers, but you never know, you know? You never know.
Research,
yeah. Yeah. He was simply referred to as either the Gaon, the genius, or the Vilna Gaon, the genius of Vilna. That's how we refer to him. Because Vilna. Vilna. Yeah, that's the town. Right. That's how. So he's just a genius. So that's what he was. So that's the. That's so the seven branches of the Noah represent the seven basic categories of wisdom. Again, all pointing to one direction, which means all wisdom should be subordinate to Torah wisdom, and all wisdom should be used to understand Torah wisdom. That's the idea of those seven branches of the menorah. The height, as you mentioned, of the menorah is not mentioned in the Torah itself. The rabbis tell us it was 18 tefachim high. We said it's about 72 inches or so, about 6 feet. But the Torah does not mention the dimensions of the menorah, which is a very curious thing because it does mention the dimensions of the other vessels of the Mishkan. So why are those dimensions left out? So Rabbi Shimshon Pinkus, he describes a lesson we can learn from that, which is if the menorah represents application and teaching and development of Torah, we might say that if the menorah is so high, I can never reach that height. That's out of my league. Who am I to try to study Torah? Who am I to try to develop my own Torah thoughts, to find my own unique place in the world of Torah understanding? But it's so wide, it's so high, it's beyond me. So the Torah leaves out the dimensions, teaches us that everybody on their own level has their way to find their portion in God's Torah. So as long as we're putting forth our best efforts, we're sincerely trying to pull out truth, so some of us, you know, might reach one tefach or two tefachs. Some of us might reach 10 tefachs, you know, maybe an inch, a 2 inch, a foot, 2 feet, 3 feet. But you don't have to reach 6 feet in Torah. You don't have to be a Torah giant. You don't have to do that. Everyone has their own unique portion of understanding God's Torah. Everyone's here for their own purpose, and everyone has their own unique portion of Torah, as we mentioned before. So for some of us, it will be less than others. But our goal is the almonds. Our goal is to put forth our best efforts. And then, if we sincerely we're working to understand the Torah, we will develop our own understanding and our own portion in God's Torah. That's the symbolism of not mentioning the height. And we'll produce those flowers. Those flowers and the knobs, the apples and the flowers of the Torah, that's the produce of Torah. Because as we study Torah, as we bind ourselves to the light of the menorah, so we're going to be able to flower on our own and produce our own unique Torah understandings. So that's the concept of not having the height of the menorah in Torah. So what I want to do, I just want to recap one more time, because again, these concepts, they could be misunderstood or mistaken. Our goal is always to understand the truth that God put in the Torah. We don't put our own interpretation in the Torah. We draw out what God said in the Torah. It's a very big difference. If we come in with a preconceived notion, then you could try to find a place where you can stick your own thought into the Torah. So that we would refer to as heresy. Because you're not trying to figure out what God's teaching us. We're trying to take what we think and putting it into God's words. That we never want to do. But somebody sincerely is trying to figure out what God is teaching us from the Torah, using the system God gave to Moshe at Mount Sinai, using the tools that were given to Moshe at Mount Sinai, using our own sincere diligence and toil in the Torah to draw out the lessons in a way which does not put our own interpretation into it, but draws out from it. And there's a big difference between the two. That's our goal. If we do that, if we put our best efforts, we'll be pulling out kernels of truth from the Torah. And some may have never been found before. You're the first one to discover that kernel of truth. That's very possible. That's called a chiddush. But if we try to take our own interpretation and stick it in, so now that's heresy. Then we're saying, you know, we know better than God. We know what God should be saying. I think God should say this. I'm going to make God say this. So that's when we look at it as a heretical approach to the Torah. Because we can't put our own thoughts. We're trying to draw out what God is saying, not put our own thoughts into what the word of the Torah actually are offering. So there's a very big difference between those two. We should never mistake that. But somebody who sincerely toils in Torah eventually will come to their own true kernel, and it will be a truth, because the Torah is infinite. And there's many layers and layers of truth, and everyone's here to discover their own layer of truth in the Torah. And it's truth. It's what God intended out of the Torah. That's the idea of innovation and chiddush within Torah development. So to recap, we have in the Beis Hamikdash, there is the Holy Ark. That's behind closed doors, Holy of Holies, not accessible to anybody besides the Kohen Gadol once a year. And that doesn't change. It's literally, it's in stone. The tablets are in stone, because that is what it is, and it's not changing. But there's a menorah sitting there. A menorah is what's supposed to bring forth the light of Torah to the world. And that menorah is the human being's partnership with God to disseminate, to draw lessons of Torah, to apply Torah to our lives, to make it applicable, to make it practical for us, to make it meaningful to us. That's the menorah. That's what helps us produce the flowers of Torah, the apples of Torah. That's the light shining forth, which illuminates our lives, the wisdom of the Torah. And with that, with the menorah itself, that's what gave the world the ability to produce in Torah. I want to add in one more very interesting thought. This is actually a Hanukkah thought, but it's related to menorah. At Hanukkah, which is the holiday we celebrate the menorah, that's very clear. The Hanukkah, the menorah was not lit. We had to find the jug of oil to light the menorah once again. That menorah, which was lit after Hanukkah time, was a very essential part of our daily life to this very day. Because at the time of Hanukkah, that was just when the Mishnah and Talmud were starting to be developed. It was not yet recorded. This is before the times of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who was the first one to record the Mishnah. The body of oral laws we have it today in the Talmud, that was not yet it was not yet written down and finalized in times of Hanukkah. The menorah, as we're saying, is what gives the world the power to teach the Torah and to draw out the truth of Torah. And that menorah is extinguished, so that means that the sages also lost an ability to teach Torah and to draw truth of Torah. Once the menorah was rekindled, after the miracles of Hanukkah, the rekindled menorah, immediately after that was when we entered into the period where they actually were started to record the Mishnah and the Talmud for eternity. And the recording of Mishnah and Talmud at that point, they were drawing from the power of the menorah lit after the Hanukkah miracle. So there was a time of darkness. The menorah was not lit, and that actually stunted our ability to draw the truth of Torah and to develop the oral law. Once the menorah was rekindled after the Hanukkah miracle, that light of the menorah was then incorporated into the Talmud. That power the menorah gave us to teach the Torah and to understand the truth of Torah, that was written in the Mishnah and Talmud, which we have in our hands this very day. So that is actually applicable to our daily lives. Anyone ever opens up a page of Mishnah or a page of Talmud, we're gaining the benefits of that menorah that is lit after the Hanukkah story. So that's how it applies to our daily lives. And you know, and the one thing we do have once a year, we light in our own homes the menorah, because the light of the Torah we still have. The divine service, the Beis Hamikdash, is gone. The Kohanim aren't doing their service anymore. We don't have a Jewish king. We can't bring offerings. A lot of things we can't do. But what we do, what we still have, is the Torah. And that symbolized that the menorah still carries on. Even though the other vessels of the temple no longer are in use, we hope to be used again soon, but at this point are not in use, the menorah is still in use. And it's in use not in the temple, but in our own homes. Because the light of Torah reaches every single Jew in their own home, no matter where they are in the world. And that's the powerful lessons of the menorah. Any questions? Yeah.